Good evening. It's a pleasure to be with you today at the Settel for this new edition of the Rendez-vous littéraire Rue Cambon. For the past 3 years, we've been looking at close bounds between literature and women's emancipation, inviting writers and friends of the house to discuss their work and literary inspirations. Tonight, I'm thrilled to welcome writer Rachel Cusk. Rachel, I first encountered your work through your memoir, A Life's Work, published more than 20 years ago, but still so relevant today. This book was a revelation to me. I had never read anything so authentic and wise about motherhood. I might as well tell you, I've been wanting to have this conversation with you for a very long time, so thank you for accepting our invitation. I'm also very pleased to welcome a dear friend of mine and an amazing woman, Naomi Campbell. Naomi, I know how precious all these subjects are to you. Needless to say, you have been a spokeswoman and an active advocate for these causes, supporting numerous charities working with women and children. We have had many conversations about motherhood and women's empowerment, and I cannot wait to continue this discussion with everyone here tonight. So thank you for all joining us. Finally, I want to introduce writer and journalist Erica Wagner, who will be moderating our conversation, and the floor is now yours.
Thank you so much, Charlotte. I'm really delighted to be here in Paris to host this wonderful event with Chanel. Rachel, our guest of honor, has made her name as a keen observer of the life and society, women's lives, all our lives. Her first novel, Saving Agnes, was published when she was just 26 and won the prestigious Whitbread First Novel Award. It is a novel about a young woman carving her path and discovering herself. And as Rachel's fiction developed, she showed us in novels such as The Country Life, In the Fold, and Arlington Park, characters who express a fascinating existential dissatisfaction with their circumstances and seek change. Family life is never enough, and her readers are asked to consider where fulfillment can ever truly lie. In her acclaimed Outline trilogy, encompassing the novels Outline, Transit, and Kudos, her narrator, Faye, lives a life which looks superficially like her author's. As a writer with children, attending literary events, living a semi-public life alongside her private one. But Faye is always a mirror for the thoughts of others. These novels act as openings through which we may consider the culture within which so many of us live. Second Place, published as Les Dépendances, won the Prix Féminin Étranger in 2022, and that is what I might call a psychodramatic comedy, when an artist, Elle, comes to stay with the narrator and her husband. Things don't turn out as one might expect, but that is always the way with Rachel Cusk's work, ever incisive and surprising. Her writing offers an acute investigation of the subject of domesticity, about how we all make our way in the world and alongside the people closest to us with brilliance. In her memoirs, A Life's Work on Becoming a Mother and Aftermath on Marriage and Separation, her rigor and truthfulness created, it is not going too far to say, a new feminist language. In France, she has made her home in Paris in recent years, and we're so glad that she hasn't had far to travel to be with us today. In the coming months, she's going to publish a new novel, Parade, which we look forward to eagerly, and we may have a few words about that. So, to get us started, Rachel, I'm going to read back a little quote from your own work, from an essay I love called Making House, about what it means to create a livable domestic space and what we might require from it. Rachel writes, "To continue creating, a person perhaps has to maintain an essential discomfort in the world. We're all very comfortable here today, but this is an essential truth. Can you elaborate on the nature of this discomfort and how creation drives you?"
I think just at a in the boldest sense, it's being outside rather than inside, outside the house rather than inside the house, and separate rather than together. As an English phrase, being a joiner, which means, are you the kind of person who joins clubs and groups and, you know, essentially any kind of artistic vocation means maintaining, I guess, a neutrality. That's probably the nicest way of putting it, which, yeah, means not getting too comfortable with anybody or anything.
Charlotte, you said a little bit about this, and it's a simple and complex question, but what's really at the heart of your love for Rachel's work?
Well, I'll say actually that discomfort Rachel was just talking about, that feeling of being uncomfortable, of being inadequate, which has a great critical power within it. And it's not always easy to be uncomfortable, but at the same time, it's something that can help you maintain that awareness. And I think that when we read Rachel's novels, she kind of pushes us to inhabit that discomfort. And that's what I really liked. And then in her style of writing, there's something quite honest and raw and at the same time very elegant and hypnotic as well. So I think that's what I really like about her work. But I would also say something quite specific is that I'm always amazed how within the most banal situations of day-to-day life, how you can raise such important philosophical questions, which is always quite fascinating because sometimes there's like a sentence, like a gem and a reflection that's so deep and that just came out of the most simple situation of a very concrete day-to-day life. So that's something I very much appreciate, and that quest of authenticity that really is something I feel strongly about Rachel's work.
Naomi, how did those ideas of comfort versus discomfort speak to you?
Well, discomfort for me breaks into vulnerability of unknowing. And as a new mother of 2.5 years, there's an insecurity that comes with that. Am I doing the right thing? There is no right and wrong, I know. Do I feel guilty because I'm a single mother and I'm working? There's so many questions that comes along with it.
I put the question to all of you. What's the difference between inside the home and outside the home? You know, the self, is it different for women than it is for men? How we balance those two selves, if there are those two selves?
Well, I think the good old word compartmentalization is probably the only, maybe the best female strategy. And if you think back to the dawn of feminism and having it all, which was the phrase, this idea that you could actually be more than one person. And I think I say somewhere in a life's work, that part of the experience of looking after very small children is this overwhelming sense of your own competence, sometimes incompetence also very often, but sometimes you think I could run America just in while she's sleeping. I could, you know, bit of world financial policy, no problem. So I think that sometimes I felt in those years that this, if you could accept being divided and existing in compartments, that it was a prospect of a kind of different kind of power.
I agree with the compartmentalization, and when I finished work, I'm finished work. When I walk through the door, I'm just a mum, and that's it. More than anything I've ever wanted to be was just mum. That's what I wanted the most, and now that's what I am, and that's what I, you know, I'm just the mum to these two kids. And Naomi is someone else, a character that's a facet of me, that's, you know, my job.
I feel kind of more conflicted. It's like, yeah, when I'm at work, or when I'm working, I'm still in the back of my mind, always thinking of home and my kids. And then when I'm with them, I'm constantly thinking about work. So it's like a little bit of...
So you want more compartmentalization?
Yeah.
Well, we're now going to have our first short extract of Rachel's work. Charlotte is going to read to us from Aftermath, Rachel's remarkable memoir of marriage and separation, or perhaps separation and marriage is a better way to put it. It's a book that deeply considers our attachments and how they define us, how we see ourselves as connected to others and how the world sees us. And by us, I mean women, of course. In this extract, Rachel considers what it might mean to be a full-time mother and what it might mean to be a working mother. Charlotte.
I know women with four children and women with no children, divorced women and married women, successful and compromised women, apologetic, ambitious and contented women, women who are unfulfilled or accepting, selfless and frustrated women. And some of them, it is true, are not financially dependent on men. What can I say about the ones that are? That they're usually full-time mothers, and that they live more through their children. That's how it seems to me. The child goes through the full-time mother like a dye through water. There is no part of her that remains uncolored. The child's triumphs and losses are her triumphs and losses. The child's beauty is her beauty and is the child's unacceptability. And because management of the child is her job, her own management of the world is conducted through it. Her subjectivity has more than one source and only a single outlet. This can result in extreme competence. Some of my friends claim to find such women frightening or threatening. These friends are generally women who sustain more than one identity out of a single self, and hence perhaps fear accusations of extreme incompetence. Their power is diffuse. They never feel it collected in one place, and as a result, they don't know how much of it there is, whether they have less or more power than that curiously titled creature, the stay-at-home mom, or indeed than their male colleagues at work, who must, I suppose, share at least some of their feelings of scatteration. A few of these working mother friends of mine have taken the occasional domestic furlough, usually in the early years of parenthood. Like wanted criminals finally run to ground, they surrender with their hands up. Yes, it was all too much, too unworkable. The running hither and thither, the guilt, the pressure at work, the pressure at home, the question of why. If you were never going to see them, you went to the trouble of having children in the first place. So they decide to stay at home for a year or two, or even things a bit up like the cake mixture the recipe tells you to divide between two tins, or which there always seems to be more in one than the other. Their husbands also work, live in the same houses, and parent the same children, yet don't seem to experience quite the same measure of conflict. In fact, sometimes they actually look like they're better at being working parents than women are, on insufferable male superiority. But a man commits no particular heresy against his sex by being a good father, and working is part of what a good father does. The working mother, on the other hand, is traducing her role in the founding myths of civilization on a daily basis. No wonder she's a little harassed. She's trying to defy her own deep-seated relationship with gravity. I read somewhere that a space station is always slowly falling back to Earth, and that every few months or so, a rocket has to be sent to push it back out again. In rather the same way, a woman is forever dragged at by an imperceptible force of biological conformism. her life is relentlessly iterative. It requires energy to keep her in orbit. Year after year, she'll do it. But if one year the rocket doesn't come, then down she'll go.
Thank you so much, Charlotte. And now, Rachel, I'll turn to you with a question a little up from this passage that we read here. You say, lately I have come to hate stories, which is perhaps a surprising statement from a writer of fiction. How do you balance, I want to say, your non-fiction self and your fictional self?
I mean, I think I always felt that my duty was to reality, and how the novel could show that and contain it. And as I lived and experienced things and changed and had more and more experiences that seemed to be consequences of my femaleness, I realized that more and more of this material couldn't go into that novel structure. And what structure then could it go into? And, you know, this, because in the end, these are questions of forms. And it seemed to me that there was a form called the memoir that you were allowed to write about yourself in. And so for a while, I guess I rode both those horses and thought that this form was for this material, and then this other form, much older form, you know, ruled by men, I guess, despite what everybody says about Jane Austen. I mean, having said that one can live as a compartmentalised person, I think that the real development in my work came in thinking, I'm going to make one thing out of these two things, and there has to be, if necessary, a new kind of novel that can hold this material. And I mean, I've always thought that change, which is very painful and usually involves losing various things, if you pay attention to it, it is what causes development. And so I think I felt at that moment that I had hung on to this commitment to reality, whatever that means, and tried to manage it and place it in various ways. But this overwhelming insight, I suppose, which was what led me to write Outline. I suppose the harvest from the discipline of trying to keep both those things going alive.
Charlotte, what speaks to you especially about this passage? I was struck by the idea of a woman's life being relentlessly iterative, endlessly repeated. What calls out to you from that?
Yeah, I do relate to that idea of repetition and redoing the same things, the same struggle every day, and repeating the same sentences, the same routine. But really what, I mean, I found very true in that passage is the idea of working men and working women with children. It's absolutely not the same story. There is still something that just deep down, where there is a kind of guilt that's very rooted and that's very deep. And then we, you know, if we're working mothers, we always fantasize about the stay-at-home mom. And I thought it was quite interesting when you talk about these women that decide to suddenly just, you know, go there, just to experiment that. And I thought that was well expressed in that passage of that conflict we feel.
Tell us a little more, Naomi, about your thoughts on, because you've now entered the world of working motherhood. Of course, you saw it growing up. You grew up with a single mother. But what really struck you, maybe what's been most surprising to you?
For me, it's about staying in the present moment. I can't let my mind wonder about the future, tomorrow, the next day, because every day is a different day and comes with it so many things. And I sometimes say, oh my God, I have 2 children under 3 years old. It's a little overwhelming. And I travel and I'm still working.
Moving smoothly on, Naomi is going to read a brief extract of a life's work, Rachel's account of becoming and being a mother, which, as I said now, was published more than 20 years ago. So it is really fascinating to think about how things have or have not changed since the book was published, and whether they've changed for the better or not necessarily. So in this extract, the author confronts how the demands of motherhood can be in conflict with the needs of the self.
To be a mother, I must leave the telephone unanswered, work undone, arrangements unmet. To be myself, I must let the baby cry. I must forestall her hunger or leave her for evenings out. Must forget her in order to think about other things. To succeed in being one means to fail being the other. The break between mother and self was less clean than I had imagined it in the taxi. And yet it was a premonition too. For later, even in my best moments, I never feel myself to have progressed beyond this division. I merely learn to legislate for 2 states and to secure the border between them. At first, I thought, I'm driven to work at the newer of the 2 skills, which is motherhood. And it is with a shock that I see, like a plummeting stock market, the resulting plunge in my own significance. Consequently, I bury myself further in the small successes of nurture. After 3 or 4 weeks, I reach a distant point, a remote outpost at which my grasps of the baby's calorific intake, hours of sleep, motor development, and patterns of crying is professional, while the rest of my life resembles a deserted settlement, an abandoned building, which is rotten timber occasionally breaks and comes crashing to the floor, scattering mice. I'm invited to a party, and though I decide to go and bathe and dress at the appointed hour, I end up sitting in the kitchen and crying, while elsewhere it's frivolous, minutes tick by and then elapse.
Thank you, Naomi. That was lovely. I wonder, Rachel, how you've thought about motherhood in other texts. So we could pick so many. I think of Mrs. Dalloway and how Clarissa Dalloway's domesticity is contrasted with the life of London after the First World War, or The Lost Daughter, Elena Ferrante's novel, where a woman's encounter with a family she meets on holiday draws her back to reconsider her own unconventional motherhood. Are there depictions of motherhood in literature that resonate with you?
I mean, I think we're agreed that there's a resounding void. If a void can resound. There is not very much writing about motherhood. There is certainly not much writing about motherhood by mothers, and the reason is that if you have a small child, writing is about the last thing that you are able to do. And it's interesting, we were talking about Balzac earlier and a novel that Charlotte was describing, in which Balzac appears to understand extremely well what it's like to have a baby, to be a woman and to have a baby. And D.H. Lawrence similarly writes the most compellingly for me about motherhood. And, you know, for me, what a life's work really represents is the sort of time and space-defying achievement of writing it, of actually writing it with a, in fact, very similar to Naomi's moment, a 6-month-old and a 2-year-old. And the fact that, you know, so much of representation is making a record, and, you know, you ask yourself, what's the point of painting this picture or writing this book? Or, but, you know, if you do it as it needs to be done as it's meant to be done. You have made a record of something, and maybe it'll take a long time for the value of that to become apparent. And for me, the fact that that record exists is something to be proud of.
Tell us a little more, Charlotte. You had an important encounter with this book. Tell us a little bit more about the sort of viscerality of that moment.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, I was very much interested in the representation of maternity in literature and philosophy, which is a catastrophe. Very few philosophers, I mean, practically none that wrote about it. So, and it's such an important experience in life. So, so then, you know, when I discovered Rachel's book, Life's Work, I was, you know, very moved by it, because it's so rare to find someone that's actually living that experience and that can actually write about it, because it's a moment where it's extremely difficult to put words on. I think it's a very brave book, and I admire the strength of Rachel to have, you know, managed that. And maybe, yeah, I think that it, what's very strong in it is all the conflicts we can feel during that moment, that divided self that never feels at the right place. And at some point in the book, you say that it's like experiencing the loss of synchronicity, where it's like a delay, like if you're on a transatlantic phone call, and it's just this constantly that delay. You cannot be in the moment. It's just you're torn between so many conflicting desires and situations, and managing simply time is just extremely difficult. So I thought that idea of losing synchronicity was just so right.
We're here, of course, with Chanel. So it's important to have a little discussion of fiction and style for our final extract. So Naomi is going to read from Second Place, in which the unnamed narrator is hunting for something to wear. Her thoughts are addressed to someone called Jeffers. L, referred to here, is the artist she has invited to stay in the artist's colony, let's call it that, that she has created, and Tony is the narrator's husband.
I opened my cupboard of clothes and I felt a sudden qualm as the prospect of trying to find what I wanted. I'm so sure that I wanted wasn't there. But as I already said, Jeffers, I had at some point given him upon the attempt to learn the language of clothes. And if someone had given me a uniform, I would have gladly have worn it every day. But instead, I devised a sort of uniform of my own, in that everything I possessed was more or less the same. But none of it answered to Elle's description, which was to wear something that fitted. And as I rummaged hopelessly in the cupboard, I remembered that before I came to the marsh, my clothes had been more fitted, and that perhaps the last day on which I had worn something fitted was the day I married Tony. Thinking this made me feel suddenly tearful, and I had the awful feeling of an unraveling deep inside me. Did Tony not appreciate me as a woman with a female form? Did I go around in shapeless clothes these days as a kind of renunciation of sexuality and beauty? Crawling in the very back of the cupboard with a sudden and instinctive certainty, I found myself putting out the very same dress I had gotten married in, which I had entirely forgotten was there. It was a beautiful, simple, close-fitting dress, and as I held it in my hands, I knew exactly it was right. While at the same time, I was beset by the waves of conflicting emotion, chief among them, a nameless kind of sorrow for the people Tony and I had been then, as if those people now no longer existed. Filled with daring, I put the dress on and was arranging my hair in front of the mirror when Tony walked into the room. Tony is rarely excited and perturbed, and this occasion was no exception. I had wondered whether he might be so moved by the sight of the dress that he wouldn't notice, hadn't I put it on for him. But he simply lifted his head a little and looked at me for a while, and then he stated, "You're wearing that dress."
Thank you so much. How did the language of clothes and the language of fiction connect for you, Rachel? I think it's interesting that it's a wedding dress, but it's not a wedding dress. It's a dress that can be worn again.
I mean, I think the same question can be asked of literature as of fashion, which is, what's it for? Is it necessary? I think the defence of clothing and fashion would be very similar. Its lack of necessity is, in fact, its chief beauty and its chief purpose, and for things to exist without being entirely necessary is pretty good definition of art, I think. So as far as wedding dresses go, I don't know what I feel about them. They're very camp, is what I think.
How do you connect fashion and literature, Charlotte?
Well, I totally agree with Rachel on the idea that it's, you know, the fact that we ask ourselves if it's necessary or not. But, you know, you can, of course, fashion is creation, literature is creation. It has the power to make you dream, to tell stories, to reinvent yourself, to travel places you'll probably never go, to project yourself into an identity that is something you will maybe never truly be, but this is something that we, of course, need in our lives, and although it's not necessary. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of similarities and in the idea of shaping yourself as well.
What does it mean to you, Naomi, to find something to wear that suits who you feel like being, either in a kind of general sense? It seems to me fashion and literature are both about imagination, imagining ourselves into other spaces.
Definitely about storytelling. And storytelling's been the whole of my career and an important factor in being here at the House of Chanel with Virginie and Carl. It was all about storytelling, it always has been, connecting it to the DNA of what Chanel was about. Those were the best times for me in terms of wearing, to feel like you know the story behind the clothes. You can really connect better with what you're wearing, and you become a character, and you show it in that way. And a lot of fun, a lot of creativity and characterization. You step outside of yourself for a moment.
As in literature. Yeah. Rachel, I want to know, you live in Paris now, as I said. You have a new book coming out, Parade, in a few months' time. And it is connected to Paris. Can you just tell us a little bit about it?
It's a sort of new direction that I've taken, I guess, which has partly arisen out of changing language culture, which is, if you're a writer and you're in your 50s, learning to operate in a different language is
enormous.
It's putting your brain in a sort of food processor, I guess. And so that's suddenly the kind of search for forms, which is what I spend a lot of time doing, became a very different thing with this this new presence of language as a veil, and it was very exciting for me to suddenly have a veil and suddenly having this clothing around language was very, very suggestive to me. And living here and thinking about biography, I guess, Paris feels like a location of that, of lives lived. And so, I mean, the book, very, very generally, uses the idea of the artist's biography as a form that one could express one's own life in. So it uses the lives of Louise Bourgeois, Eric Rohmer, Baselitz, as vehicles for sort of autobiography, mine or somebody's.
If you want a little preview, there's an extract in The New Yorker. Is there a book that you feel particularly strongly about?
I feel strongly about books, and I think that people find books in the most extraordinary ways and at the most extraordinary times, and that books, a book you read at 16 that changes your life when you read it at 36 means nothing to you and you can't understand. So I think I'm always giving people books and then being really annoyed because I can't find them on my own bookshelves. But I like to think that I've put a lot of them out into the world, and I think I probably have a good repertoire of books that I associate with particular periods of life, states of mind.
And you were talking just now about Parade. You've written a lot about other forms of art, visual artists, filmmakers. How do you see that intersection between the written word and other forms?
I think I've become increasingly obsessed with the image, and I think part of what Parade is an interest in lives that produce an image or images rather than lives that produce narrative. And I think because the links between narrative and living appear to be very clear and strong, there's a mystery between the life of the image maker and the image that is made that I think is very kind of potent. And it used to be the case that you were not allowed to think about artists' lives or talk about their lives, or wasn't allowed to have anything to do with the idea of explaining a work of art in terms of the life of the artist. So I wish to complicate that picture and to interrogate a little bit these lives that somehow allowed the mystery of an image to be their fruit. I also have a massive jealousy of visual artists. My husband is an artist. I'm quite jealous of him.
So there's that.
And not just because he gets to be with me. it seems not dealing in the language economy seems an incredibly tantalising idea to me.
I understand. Any questions? Are we going to have any questions? Raise your hand high. Otherwise, we're all going to have to go home.
There's one.
Oh, yes, there we go. Very good. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. This is so inspiring hearing you talk and read and ask all these interesting questions. I don't know if mine is going to be that interesting, but I'm interested in the question of comfort and discomfort that you mentioned. I'm an architect, and I often ask myself this question, you know, how far do we go in the comfort zone that we create spaces where we suddenly feel so comfortable that we don't question anything anymore. I was lucky to work with Mr. Lagerfeld in these walls as well here, and I watched him draw and sometimes seek this sense of just finding the little balance between comfort and discomfort and the allure of a chair or a space. So coming back to your notion, Rachel, of comfort and discomfort, in a world so adverse out there, isn't this our greatest luxury, to be able to define that balance between comfort and discomfort?
I mean, that's a beautiful idea, beautifully put. I think that there still have to be night watchmen who stay awake and it's quite uncomfortable being a night watchman. But that, I suppose, is how I see some people, possibly me, sometimes functioning in culture, not allowing things to go unscrutinized from a position of total clarity and objectivity. And the idea of the balance and the is a good strategy for living, I would say. But I guess I think that it goes back to Charlotte's point right at the beginning about paying attention. Someone has to pay attention. And to really, really, really specifically get something right, set out the terms very, very specifically, and maybe so that other people can find balance. That's a nice idea.
I'm just going to briefly take, that was a wonderful question, I'm going to turn it to Naomi and Charlotte, because it brought in Karl Lagerfeld, were in his space, and you were talking before, Naomi, about how comfortable he made you feel. That's a sense I get from both of you. And again, maybe just a word from each of you about that sense of balance from him.
Yeah, I guess that's quite true, that Karl had that capacity of creating at the same time comfort and discomfort as well, because he was extremely witty and very sharp. So you never knew exactly, you know, which direction he would go. And so there was always something so sharp that keeps you very alert. And that awareness was constantly there. So
if we use the word discomfort, I find that he, with Karl, it was more in the pushing and the creative sense. It pushed the boundary. We did something different that we had never done before. And, I mean, today when I walked in here, I haven't been here since he was alive. And I just want to say what Virginie's done to keep 7L alive is amazing. And to have this initiative to be here today, Charlotte, for Rendezvous, a safe place to learn, listen and share, it's a really great initiative. I'm really happy to be here today. And for me, it's... he was just someone that was constantly learning, and he would know everything about music and what he was up to date on everything. And I found it was always just best to be your authentic self with Karl. If he asked you a question, answer it in the most honest way. If you shied away and everything, he might not remember you. If you were yourself, he wanted you to be yourself. He wanted us to be on the catwalk. Virginie would say, be yourself. They would tell us to be ourselves. And that was to be ourselves, part of the storytelling. So those were great times.
That's a beautiful note to end on. What a pleasure it has been, and so enormous. Thanks to you, Charlotte, Chanel ambassador and the driving force behind the Rendezvous Littéraire, the whole wonderful Chanel team, and of course, Rachel Cusk and Naomi Campbell. Thank you so much.